Community-centered maintenance is one of a handful of different approaches. And really, reliability-centered maintenance is a collection of approaches or decision points in how you conduct your maintenance program. But it started some years ago, and let's take a look at one of the key findings of a study from the mid-70s. In a report by Nolan and Heap, I believe it was sponsored by the Air Force, is they did an in-depth research and study of the maintenance practices of United Airlines. And they looked at the flights, the equipment, the different kinds of approaches and techniques they used to do maintenance. And they gathered just a whole pack of information. And one of the things they noticed, and you'll see this in many different references and books, is a depiction of these six different curves. And let's see if I can get my pen to work. And the top one looks a whole lot like what we would typically call a bathtub curve. And it's a plot of the hazard function. It's the instantaneous failure rate over time. So we have time and little h of t here. And they didn't put units on these because they were probably a collection of different patterns that they noticed, or is the way they described it in the text. And so some had relatively short time frames and others had much longer ones. But they noticed as they looked through the data that there were these six dominant patterns. And so some components actually had some wear out or early life failure mechanism, and then a period of some relatively stable or consistent failure rates. And then eventually they would go into a wear out pattern, what we typically would call a bathtub curve. But only about 4% of all of the parts that they tracked, and it wasn't clear in the report how many components they actually plotted and evaluated, but they had access to thousands and thousands of components that were involved in the normal maintenance and upkeep of the fleet of aircraft. But only 2% actually only showed a wear-out mechanism where they started at some failure rate and eventually increased. But a good number of components showed either just a modest amount of increase in failure rate over time, or initially it was really good and then it eventually came up to some steady level, or just what we would typically call an exponential failure rate. And the vast majority showed, this is 68% of the components, showed some proclivity to fail early on, and then over time it would settle down to a more standard failure rate. Now, this is one set of data, and it was in the mid-70s when this was collected. And keeping in mind that the process in vogue at that time was to do an overhaul after some fixed amount of number of flights or fixed number of hours of operation, and lots of things were replaced or repaired long before they would go into wear-out mechanisms. So it's not surprising that less than 6% of the units that they were concerned with exhibited this wear-out mechanism. And it's because they were very proactive and in some cases would strip down an airframe and replace everything on it after, I think it was on the order of 5 to 10 years, somewhere in there. So there were some pretty aggressive practices of just never getting to the point where you got wear out. Now, some parts and systems still did exhibit some wear out mechanisms, but it was a very minor amount. But they had all these different patterns. And one of the conclusions of that is knowing the pattern of failures for a particular component or subsystem is what should really dictate how you approach the reliability, or I'm sorry, the maintenance practices concerning that part. So if you're doing inspections or you're doing a routine maintenance and you're noticing that this component is getting older and it has an increasing failure rate, well, then that indicates the spot in time, for example, in this curve, when you should just replace it as a preventative measure to avoid the increasing failure rate probabilities. And what Nolan and Heap noticed, though, is that the vast majority of their components wouldn't fall under that preventative approach where you would preemptively replace a component to avoid an increase in failure rate. A good number of parts were relatively benign increases or no increase in failure rate. So the only real viable or economic practice was to run to failure. Now, what doesn't show in here, because of the nature of the practices at the time is that each one of these curves could exhibit a wear-out mechanism at some point. And so that it wasn't sufficient data because they were replaced irregardless of their practice, of the pattern of its failure rates at a major overhaul type period. So this was what made this study so unique, is that it allowed people to understand that if you track and understand the pattern of failure rates for your particular components, is that would then dictate how you would approach the reliability of it. So understanding the time dependence of your failure rate became much more important. And I feel, and this is an aside, is that this message has gotten lost, and that I see this same basic set of graphs shown, and they're saying that 68 to 72, 82, 89, 94% or thereabouts of the types of failure rates you experience, exponential works rather well. And giving justification to just use exponential distribution. Well, the notion is that this was artificial and not representing the actual failure rate pattern over the full lifetime of a component, because they were artificially and expensively replaced and refurbished well before they got into any wear-out mechanisms. And so don't read too much into their particular data, because it was in the mid-70s with aircraft of that time and maintenance practices of that time. But I think the takeaway message really is understand the pattern of failures for your components, and then what makes sense for you to either provide replacements or repairs or refurbishments or inspections, or watching for the changes in failure rates that are meaningful for your reliability program and the way you approach that, doing repairs and replacements. Now, RCM, the reliability-centered maintenance, does require some information. We no longer can just wait for symptoms of failure and then execute a corrective maintenance. Here we're looking for those things that are concerning: what exactly is failing, and how do we monitor and measure that, and then breaking that down into what are the causes, and then what happens because of that. Now, that information goes into prioritization and cost of failure and all those kinds of aspects. But then it drives then how frequently we do inspections or how frequently we do replacements. And then why does it matter? Let's connect this maintenance activity to our business. And then furthermore, can we predict these things? Can we create a sustainable ongoing operation of our equipment, and understanding and characterize the expected probabilities of failure over each mission or each flight, say, for an aircraft? And then more importantly, is what can we do to prevent failures? So lubrication and cleaning and maintenance are common techniques that have been in practice long before RCM came around. But there's also practices of evaluating the onset or symptoms of the onset of failures. So cracks, for example, in an airframe, and I was surprised to learn that all airframes have some number of cracks. It's just that when they get to a certain size, that then we would take the maintenance team would take action and repair or replace those elements that were cracking. But the notion is that what can we do to mitigate or avoid future failures? So things like alignment and cleaning and lubrication practices, managing temperature and stresses that the system is applied to, and so on, are all ways for us to go about doing that. Another very common technique is to do preventative maintenance, where we're actually going to say replace the system before it can exhibit an increase in failure rate. But timing that, rather than on a fixed clock schedule, say every 3 months, is like my car now, it has a sensor and it's monitoring how many miles I've driven. And I'm sure the algorithm's a little more complicated than that, but it gives me a signal saying I need to do an oil change in the near future. Or more likely what I get is it's overdue after I ignore the initial messages. But reliability-centered maintenance is putting reliability of the elements that you're trying to maintain back into consideration rather than just waiting for symptoms of failure before doing anything. The basic steps are is that the product or the system that we're operating on should be designed to be maintainable. So access and sensors and equipment and systems that give us information as to, well, do two things, I should say. Is one is make it possible to do maintenance. So if a part is going to fail, it should be replaceable within the system. And that includes that it's something that allows us to do replacements, but also we have access to it. And then we have diagnostics and everything else that indicate that this is the part that needs replacement to restore the system to operation. The other part of design for maintainability is thinking through, well, what's the logistics train for this? What's the cost-benefit elements of this? What can we replace and make possible to replace that makes sense? And how do we go about doing that? But it starts in the design. And then there's also these elements of risk assessment and looking at the failures and what kind of distributions we have. Is it a early life failure or wear out mechanisms or some combination? And then it's also looking at, well, what are the typical maintenance intervals that this style of system would have? What is our technician teams and folks doing the maintenance? What's in their skill set in order to operate and maintain and inspect and execute? But it's not necessarily based on a specific set of intervals. There might be different things you do at different points in time, say in a monthly or quarterly or annual basis, but the timing may be based on operation if that's what's dominant to cause failures for your system. So it can vary dramatically depending on the failure mechanisms, the underlying causes of failure. And then there's also elements of, well, can it be inspected? Can we actually detect through inspection or monitoring or measurement that we have an issue and that's going to need attention soon? But put all these things into a plan. Let's take a look at our schedule and scheduled maintenance for your, say, your car. It comes with a guideline to that. Here's the types of checks and inspections you should do regularly. Here's the types of things you should replace or replenish or restore, like oil changes. And then there's other elements of looking at timing belts, for example, over longer periods of time, and a number of other inspection points that go into your vehicle. A lot of repairable systems include this kind of sets of detail now that we're really doing reliability-centered maintenance across many, many different kinds of systems. And again, it goes back to looking at the types of failures we see and the patterns over time that they have. And we can look back to Nolan and Heap for really bringing that to the forefront in the maintenance world. Now, there's a couple different ways of looking at maintenance. Is up until about World War II, most maintenance was rather simple compared to today's systems, and it was typically done as needed when something failed or when it made sense. It was pretty often just run to failure and fix it when you have a failure. Systems were simpler than they are today. Just electronics alone complicated our systems, but they were also easier to maintain. They were usually built robustly and simply, and that enabled the ability to do maintenance on these systems. The second generation was about from World War II on, when systems did get more complex and became electrical mechanical systems, and later in the 60s things became more driven with some software elements and were much more complicated from electronics point of view, is in those cases then there was a regular set of overhauls. So a system might run for 5 or 10 years and then be completely refurbished and replaced, all of the elements replaced. And if things weren't just run to failure, then they were run to a set time point, in which case things were basically rebuilt in restarting the clock for that particular system. And then in the late 70s, in part the time when Nolan and Heap wrote their report, there was a move towards looking at the specific failure mechanisms and minimizing the failure rates that our system would see by selectively and carefully doing either inspections and repairs or doing maintenance of cleaning and lubrication, for example, or other activities that were based on the behaviors over time of specific failure mechanisms. Now, maintenance continues to evolve, and I don't know whether we're in the fourth generation or not, but it's pretty prevalent now that most teams are approaching their maintenance tasks with a reliability-centered maintenance kind of approach. Well, next, though, we'll take a look at a slightly different strategy that's evolved from Japan, and it's called total productive maintenance. I think that's what it's called. Let me double check before we start the next section.